All right, we are going to be continuing. My name is Pastor Kyle, and we're going to be continuing in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. Last week, we actually started David's portion of this story, and we've been starting this journey that David's going to go on as he continues to rebuild the kingdom. And if you haven't caught what Pat's been doing, it's kind of neat, and I wanted to share it with you so that you would know as you listen to his calls to worship over the next few weeks. From now until the end of this series, when we get through the end of 2 Samuel, the psalms that Pat is reading as the introduction, as our call to worship, correspond to the psalms that likely David was writing at the time period of the story we're talking about that day. So around the time that David was a shepherd boy last week, Pat looked at Psalm 23, which is the Good Shepherd. It was likely a psalm that David wrote while out with the sheep, tending the sheep. So the psalm and the poetry and the emotions that David is pouring out on the page in the Psalms corresponds to the events of his life that we're studying through the rest of this book. It's just kind of neat to know that as you hear those week in and week out for the coming weeks, that's why he's choosing those psalms. And it's just a fun thing that he's doing for us. If you've not been with us up until this point in the book, just by way of review, here's what we've seen so far. The book of Judges that we studied last year was a march to the bottom. Judges is entirely about Israel making bad decision after bad decision as they march downward towards one of the lowest points in Israelite history. But in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, God says he is going to use the prophet Samuel to start the journey back to restoring Israel to what he intended it to be. He's going to use Samuel and the kings that come after him to start the journey back to the top. But initially, God warns them and says, look, I want to be your king. I am your God. I am your leader. I am your ruler. I want you to follow me. And if you choose a king for yourself, if you choose to go with an earthly human king, what's going to happen is that king is just going to take from you. He's going to take in your taxes. He's going to take in your armies. He's going to take from you over and over and over again. But when Israel heard this, they chose to not choose God. They instead chose to choose a earthly king. And as Audrey laid it out, if you weren't here for that sermon, you can go back and listen to it. It is online. They chose to eat the pepper. They chose to do the thing that they had been warned about that would cause them pain, that would cause them hurt, and they chose to do it anyway. But then we saw that God, in his infinite mercy and his love for his people, said that in spite of the fact that they chose this earthly king over him, he still promised not to forsake them as a result. He would still be there for them. He would still go with them throughout the rest of time. But their first king that they chose, Saul, we saw that pride ended up being his downfall. He ended up thinking that he knew better than God did. And when God had said, look, if you follow me, I will bless you as king. If you don't follow me, I'm not going to bless you as king. Saul chose to not follow. Saul said, I know that's your plan, God, but I know better. And he went his own way. And that ended up being his downfall. So then last week we saw that David has now been anointed as Saul's replacement. God has said, this shepherd boy, this David, this man after my own heart, he's going to be the one who will eventually replace Saul. But that doesn't happen immediately. David's been given the promise that he will one day be king. God has told through Samuel that this is coming, but that doesn't happen for a while. And this is where we hit a point in the book where things can sometimes get a little bit confusing. Because Israel and the Jewish nation at this point in time has a predominantly oral history. And as a result, things in storytelling, when you tell a story, don't always end up in perfect chronological order. In fact, sometimes things can get a little confusing. If you don't believe that, just have a conversation with anybody on earth and ask them to tell you a story from when they were in high school. Presuming they're not still in high school. But what you will get is a story that usually starts with, well, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. Oh, wait, but this happened back here. And then, but this is going to happen later. And people will tell stories out of order all the time because when we're sharing things orally, we remember things part of the way through the story. So the story doesn't always adhere to the most chronological path. We're going to see some of that this morning because you're going to say, wait, Saul is meeting David for the first time, but we just we just read about the fact that Saul already met David, and now he's going to meet David again, and it's the nature of an oral history that is okay. It would have been fine for the Jewish nation. No one in an Israelite culture would have been bothered by that in the slightest. So that's what's happening there. When you hit that point, and you're like, wait, that what's going on? That's what's going on. All right, so with that in mind, we're going to jump into one of the most famous stories from Scripture of all time, one that you have heard 1,000 times before if you've grown up in church. Even if you didn't grow up in church, I can almost guarantee you've heard parts of this story before. If you have ever watched sports in your life, you have heard this story referenced. Because anytime somebody little is going against somebody big, we talk about the story we're going to see today. That story is, of course, David and Goliath. Absolutely. Immediately after we get the story of David being anointed to be the next king, this is the story we get. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socah, which belongs to Judah. And they were encamped between Socah and Azekah." And yeah, I'm not even going to try it. "And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and a weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and the shield bearer went before him." So here's the big piece of information you need to know about Goliath. Goliath was big. Everybody's surprised. What? Yeah. Like, if you don't have a scope in your brain for how big Goliath is, take just this last part, this idea about the spear. If you go back into our kids' area, look on the one wall, we actually have a rebuilt replica of the spear to the dimensions described here, of what Goliath's spear would have looked like. And back in that area, you can go and you can lift it and see just how heavy that was. We did that because Chuck Canterbury, who was a blacksmith, and a couple of our other men got together and they built this to scale to see how big was it going to be. And we put it on display back there. So you can see it, you can touch it, you can realize this guy was not a little guy. It's estimated somewhere between 9 and 12 feet tall. So like, almost as tall as Zeb, right? Like, no, like the tallest guy I know of is like 6'8", 6'9". I know there's some basketball players taller than that. 9 feet is the shortest they think this guy was. He's huge. And he is the one who is coming out as the champion for the Philistines. He stood and he shouted at the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out and drawn up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." This is actually a fairly traditional taunt or conversation that takes place throughout history when armies come together. It's this, look, you all don't want to be here. You're the only reason you're here is because you serve your king, Saul. And look, we don't really want to be here either. The only reason we're here is because we serve our leaders of the Philistines. So why should we all go to battle and why should we all die serving one guy who doesn't really care about you anyway? So why don't you send out a representative and we'll send out a representative? That way only one person has to die and we'll get this all settled. Right? We see this theme show up in Homer's The Odyssey. We see it in the Iliad. We see it here in Scripture. There's stories told that the game of chess was invented for this very reason. That two kings said that we're going to get together and rather than send all our armies to battle and have everybody die, we're going to play this new game that we came up with that perfectly simulates the battlefield, and whoever wins this game between us, we'll just say that that's the winner of the battle. And this is often given as a taunt. The thing is, I don't think in all of history anybody has ever lived up to one of these. Because end of the day, one guy wins over the other, and the losing army goes, well, yeah, but there's still all of us. You only killed one of us. We can still do this whole war thing. And it's never worked. But this is Goliath's taunt. And the Philistine, this is Goliath, says, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And when Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And here is the main theme of this section. When this big guy, this giant, shows up and starts taunting Israel, Israel's response is fear. The king of Israel, Saul, the one who was supposed to be the one leading them and reminding them of whom they serve, when he sees this giant, he's afraid. This is the response of Israel, and it's fear. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. And in the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. That's Jesse. Jesse was an old man in the days of Saul. And the three oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, the next to him, Abinadab, and the third, Shammah. David, he was the youngest of 8. The 3 eldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And for 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. This is Samuel. Now, going back to remind us who David is. David is the youngest. David's the unimportant one. David's the one who's supposed to be back watching the sheep. In fact, he doesn't even go to war when his 3 older brothers go to war. He is still taking care of the sheep. And he still goes to the battle lines to see what's going on. But at night, he's got to go back and take care of the sheep because he's not the one who's considered capable to go to battle. He's the youngest. He's the stay-at-home guy. And this has been going on now for 40 days. 40 days, Goliath has been coming out and taunting the Israelites morning and evening. And Jesse said to David, his son, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain. And these 10 loaves, and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Go take them some food. Also, take these 10 cheeses to their commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well, and bring some token home from them. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the provisions and went. And as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line shouting the war cry. So David, at the instruction of his father, has come into the camp. But today, this day, he comes and everyone's getting ready for battle. Everyone's got their armor on. Everyone's going up to the battle line. This has been happening for 40 days, but this time David is there at just the time that he can go up with them. And they're all going up to battle. And what's going to happen? It's day 41. It's been happening for the last 40 days. We can expect it's going to happen again on day 41. Goliath's going to come out, right? And that's exactly what happens. Israel and the Philistines, they draw up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper and the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. And he talked with them. Behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the rank of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. On day 41, as they're going up to battle, Goliath comes up and says the same thing he's been saying for 40 days. For 40 days, morning and evening, Goliath has come up. 40 days, Goliath has said, if you send out one man and he can defeat me, we will surrender to you. If you can't and I defeat him, you surrender to us. Who's man enough? Who's big enough? Who's going to come fight this giant? For 40 days, he's been taunting them with this. But on day 41, there is one thing different. David heard him. This is the pivotal moment of dun, dun, dun. David now is here. This is the John Wick moment. If you're a fan of the John Wick fans, they killed the dog. David heard him. This is going to change everything. Because all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, they fled from him. They were very much afraid. Again, Samuel pointing out, their response is fear. And the men of Israel say, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. It's like everyone is afraid of this dude. So much so that the king himself is afraid of him. The king is so afraid of him that if somebody will just go take care of him, if somebody will go do the job that the king should actually be doing, he will pay that man with great riches. He's going to make him his son-in-law. He's going to make him a part of the kingly household. If someone would just step up and do what the king should be doing. And David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? Like, say that again. That's kind of interesting to me. For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him in the same way, so shall it be done to the man who kills him. David's like, wait, Saul's going to do what now? He's going to give great riches and his daughter in marriage? Like, I'm listening now. Why such a great reward? This guy's nothing. Remember, this is David. He's the youngest. He's the smallest. He's kind of handsome. He's actually kind of a pretty boy, right? It's David. And he's like, what? This guy? This guy's nothing. He's defying the armies of the living God. Like, we've got God on our side. Who's this? So when everybody else is looking at this giant going, yep, I'm scared, responding with nothing but fear, David looks at it and goes, this midget? We got God. We've got the giant. Who's this? Now Eliab, his oldest brother, hears him talking like that. He says he heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep out in the wilderness? I know your presumption, the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. And David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word? Eliab's going, look, I know you, runt. I know you, brother, like only a brother can say with that sneer in his voice. Who, aren't you supposed to be taking care of the sheep? What are you doing out here? You just came out here to see the battle. You came out here to sneak into the movie theater and watch the movie with the rest of us. You want to see what the fun thing is. Go home, take care of the sheep. And David said, look, I'm just talking. Like, I'm saying the things that you should all be saying already. And he turns away from him, his brother, toward another. And he spoke in the same way. And the people answered him again as before. And the words of David spoke were heard. They repeated them before Saul. And he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. He's like, Saul, you don't have to be afraid anymore. You shouldn't have been afraid in the first place. Don't let your heart fail. Don't be upset about this. Our God has this. I'll prove it to you. I'll go fight the guy. I will go fight this Philistine. He's not all that big. I got it. Saul says to David, no, you don't. No, he says, you are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for you're but a youth. And he has been a man of war from his youth. He says, this guy, not only is he big, he has been fighting wars. He's been attacking and destroying people from the time he was a kid. And you're just a kid. If you haven't caught it yet, right as you enter our front door, our main entrance to the church, we've got a giant pallet out there now with the theme verse for our mega sports camp this year, our VBS. And that theme verse is, let no one despise you because of your youth. David is a phenomenal example of that quote. That quote is Timothy in the New Testament, but this is David in the Old Testament going, what does my youth have anything to do with it? My youth is not going to fight this guy. My strength is not going to go fight this guy. my God's going to go fight this guy. But Saul can't see it. Saul's looking at this runt of a kid and saying, look, I'm the king and I don't want to fight this guy. Who are you? You're a kid. You're a youth. This isn't going to go well for you. But David said to Saul, okay, your servant, David, used to keep sheep with his father. And when there came a lion or a bear, and he took a lamb from the flock, I went after him. I struck him, and I delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul says to David, go, and the Lord be with him. David's like, okay, Saul, you're terrified because of this guy, this man. He's like, I have fought lions and bears, and God has showed up in such incredible ways that I went hand to hand with lions and bears, and they were no problem for God. God took care of them. Like, think about that. This is not an African safari hunt, right? Where from 3 miles away, a mile away, with my rifle well scoped in, I can see that thing way over there, and I can shoot it, and I can win this hunt. This is me, or David, certainly not me, walking up to a lion, says, grabbing him by the beard and going to town. This is the level of fearless that David is when he is with his God. He's like, when I know that I've got God on my side, I don't just go toe-to-toe with a lion. I go up and I yank on his chin hairs and I put him down because he took a lamb from me. How much more so if God is going to defend the lamb, if God's going to empower me to defend a lamb, a sheep, a baby sheep, how much more so will God show up to defend the people that he has promised to not forsake? How much more so will God show up to defend his children? He's like, we've got nothing to worry about. And miraculously, and I say that with all seriousness because this is not Saul's heart. He listens. He hears David and he says, okay, you're right. Go. And may the God who defended you from the lion, may the God who defended you from the bear, may that God go with you because you're gonna need it. And Saul clothed David with his armor. He put on a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor. And he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David put them off. And this is the point in the story where I've always heard it said, well, David needed to go with the armor he was comfortable with. And David needed to use the sling because the sling is what he was comfortable with. Except David didn't talk about using a sling. David didn't talk about using armor. Those aren't the things that he had tested. When David here says that he had not tested the armor, he had not tested the sword, the thing that he had tested, the thing that he had put to the test was not his sling, it wasn't his staff, it wasn't his sword, it was his God. He had tested his God. He knew that when God showed up, he defeated lions and bears. That's what he just said. So when he puts on the king's armor, he goes, yeah, I haven't tested these things. These things aren't the thing that have saved me in the past. They're not the thing that's going to save me today. The thing that's going to save me is God. So then he takes his staff in his hand. He chooses 5 smooth stones from the brook, and he put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth. Second time he's disdained because of his youth. Ruddy and handsome in appearance. The Philistine makes the same mistake that Saul made. The Philistine makes the same mistake that David's brother made. He looked and he saw David. David hasn't made this mistake. David doesn't think David's going to battle. David knows God's the one going to battle. So the Philistine says to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. The Philistine Goliath says, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to feed you to the beasts of the field. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to put you out for the birds to eat. This would have been an incredible insult to an Israelite. They had very specific burial traditions, very specific commands from God how a person should be cared for. The idea of being left out to the birds would have been incredibly offensive. As David says to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and a spear and with a javelin. He says, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the army of Israel's whom you have defiled, or you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. We don't have time. I thought about like having Zeb come up here and like stand here while I told him like, I'm going to punch you in your face, Zeb. And like, this would have looked hilarious. Like, David probably couldn't have even reached the guy. And what he's saying to him is, yeah, today, God's going to knock you down, and I'm going to cut off your head with my stick and my sling. Because here's the crazy thing. David doesn't even have a sword with him. And he's threatening to cut off this guy's head. It's going to be a long time with the paper cuts. Like, it's not going to happen. And I will give the dead bodies of the hosts of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all his assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. What he's saying is, I'm going to kill you, but not out of some great desire for conquest. And not so that you can all serve us. In fact, I'm just going to wipe you all out. I'm going to do this. I'm going to defeat you. We're going to kill you today so that everyone on this planet will know that there is a God in Israel who is stronger than and more tangible than any of your gods, any of your idols. It's like, we're going to kill you, we're going to wipe you out, and everyone will know that the reason was not because of this little shepherd boy, but because of God. And here's the neat thing. Some 3,000 to 5,000 years later, everyone on the planet knows this story. Some 3,000 to 5,000 years later, even in a secular environment such as ESPN, they're still talking about David and Goliath. They're still talking about the little guy who does everything we're about to see because there was a God in Israel. Because when it was not possible, there was a God in Israel. And when the Philistine arose and came to draw near to meet David, David ran out quickly towards the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his hand. Yeah. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell to his face to the ground. No sword, no shield, one stone and one God. And this guy falls down, face dead. And so David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. This moment when God shows up and David defeats Goliath, it has reverberated through time in such a way that even today we're still talking about the great artists. If you've ever seen the Statue of David, I was in high school before I saw it from any multiple angles. I didn't realize he's got a sword in his hand and he's got the head of Goliath in his other hand. Like, this story has reverberated in such a way that David goes and he pulls Goliath's own sword, chops off his head, and thousands of years later, we're still capturing it in art. We're still putting it in art that we're creating. When God shows up, the impossible becomes possible. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shaarim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. So he brought the head to his king, but he kept the armor as a reward. And as soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." And as soon as David returned from striking down the Philistines, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." And as soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David, because he loved him as his own soul. We talked about Jonathan a couple weeks ago, and someone asked the question afterwards, why has nobody ever written a book or done more of a study on Jonathan? Because Jonathan is this incredible character that we see through the life of Saul and David, Saul's son. And his best defining trait is Jonathan absolutely knows how to be the guy next to the guy. He is your perfect second chair leader. He is always the guy standing next to the guy, and he has this wonderful ability to pick the right guy. As it turns out, I found out that actually Alex Nobles, he's the associate pastor down at Wyoming, is actually writing a book on Jonathan as we speak. So I thought that was kind of cool. But this Jonathan is a phenomenal second chair leader. And at this point, he had been following his father, the man that God had appointed as king. But as soon as he meets David, without even knowing that God has anointed him to be the next king, when he shows up, Jonathan goes, "Yeah, this is the guy." And he loves him as if he was his own soul, and he knits himself to him. And he goes, "I am going to follow this guy. He is going to be my brother, and I'm going to serve him." And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him, gave it to David, his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him. So that Saul set him as over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So David starts having all kinds of success as he goes out and he serves the king as a warrior. And as they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistines, the women came out of the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And a few weeks ago, when we saw that Saul had killed 1,000 men, and he was bragging about his 1,000 men, I told you, hold on to this statement because it's going to be significant later. This is where it's significant. He says, "And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, 'Saul has struck down his thousands, but David his 10,000s. Saul was a cool guy. He did some stuff. It was great. He was a good warrior. But now that David's here, Saul doesn't matter anymore. We've seen Saul's temperament. We've seen how Saul reacts to this kind of stuff. This isn't going to go well. Saul does not take well to being number two. He wants to be number one. And now the people are starting to realize Saul's not number one anymore.' Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, 'They have ascribed to David 10,000s. He hasn't killed 10,000. No one's killed 10,000. And to me, they've only ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom? They're going to make him king.' And Saul eyed David from that day on." He's keeping an eye on him because he's like, they like him so much better than me, they're going to take my kingdom away from me and they're going to give it to him instead. Yep. In fact, God already told Saul that was coming. Saul was one of the ones he said, "The kingdom isn't yours anymore. I'm going to give it to somebody after my own heart." He knows that he's being replaced. He doesn't know that David has already been given that promise. That Samuel has already gone to David and said, "Yeah, the guy who's going to replace him is you. It has nothing to do with the people. God is going to replace him with David." So Saul's keeping an eye on David. And it says, "The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. And Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, 'I will pin David to the wall.' But David evaded him twice." Two times this happened. And Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Again, the scripture connected to Saul is fear. Saul realizes, God isn't with me anymore. God has left me, and it looks like God is now with this David guy. And what that does is that creates fear in Saul. And the crazy thing about fear is it'll get us to do some pretty crazy, stupid things. Fear is the source of so many problems, so much strife in our lives, because we fear the things that are in front of us more than we respect the God who is behind us. And in this case, Saul is so afraid of David that he tries to kill him twice. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander over 1,000. And he went out and came in before all the people, and David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in a fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and he came in before them. So God is making it very clear, he is behind David. Everything David does just turns out as gold. And Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I that I and who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be the son-in-law to the king?" Saul's like, you can marry my daughter. Just go out and fight the Philistines. Because Saul's thinking, you know what? You know what the best way to get a man dead is? Send him to war. Send him to war, there's a pretty good chance he doesn't come back. So, you want to marry my daughter? You want to be part of the kingdom? Great, go to war. And that'll fix the problem, because he'll be dead. But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, Saul, assuming David's going to be dead anyway, she was given to Adriel, the that one, for a wife. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So Saul said, "Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." All right, so he kind of swindles David and doesn't give him the daughter he promised, but instead, Michal loves him, so he's going to give her Michal. Give him Michal. Because still, that means the Philistines will kill him and everything will be great. Because Saul says to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law. And Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David in private and say, 'Behold, the king has delight in you and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law.' And Saul's servants spoke these words in David's ears. And David said, 'Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation?' And the servants of Saul said to him, 'Thus and so did David speak.' And Saul said, 'Thus shall you say to David, the king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies.'" David's like, "I couldn't possibly afford to pay the dowry to be the king's son-in-law. I'm a poor guy. My dad's a poor guy. We can't do this." And Saul says, No. "You don't have to pay me anything. Don't worry about that. Just know the Philistines, my enemies, I want 100 of their foreskins. You thought grabbing the beard of a lion was bad. How in the world is he going to pull this off?" Like, this is absolute death for David. 100 Philistines he'd have to kill to pull this off. And Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David arose and went, and along with his men, killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. "You want 100? Double. I'll go give you double what you asked for." He doesn't die. He gives him more than what he asked for. So Saul gives him his daughter Michal for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, son's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle. And as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. Again, familiar story. Many people are familiar with the story of David and Goliath. So what does it mean for us today? How does that affect our lives today? Well, one, this is the age-old story of David and Goliath. God is the one who fights the battle, not us. David didn't defeat Goliath. David never claimed to have defeated Goliath. God defeated Goliath. Goliath died by his own sword because God decreed that all the world would know that the God of Israel was greater than the God of any other nation. And he destroyed Goliath. When God is for us, the reality is no one can be against us. Not giants, not opposing armies, not the king. When God is behind David, there is nothing, lion, bear, nothing that can be against us. But even in saying that, the reality is there will always be an enemy. As you are a follower of Jesus, as you are a follower of God, whether you were an Israelite thousands of years ago, or whether you're a member of God's church and body today, there has always been and there will always be an enemy. And the mistake is to assume that that will always be Satan, because it won't. In David's story, he had to fight Goliath. But he also had to go up against Saul. Goliath was a Philistine. That was an expected place. He knew they were at war with the Philistine army. He knew that that was where he was going to find opposition. There was no shock. There's no surprise there. But the fact that the king of Israel, the man who was supposed to be leading them, the man who was supposed to be showing them how to be godly, that man also tried to kill David. At this point in the story, twice. Twice as many times as the Philistine, Saul has now tried to kill David. See, we assume we know where our attacks will come from. We should always know that there will be enemies that will catch us off guard. They'll come from places we don't expect. But even when that happens, it's not our battle to fight. It's God's. The response to that is not to get angrier. The response to that is not to get bigger or to go buy a better sword or to get better armor. The answer is turn to God and let God be the one to fight the battle on your behalf. Because when God is for us, no one can be against us. Let's pray. God, you are so wonderful in the way that you establish your name, you defend your name, and you bring so much to the forefront as to why we should be worshiping you, that even thousands of years ago, you act, and we remember, and we celebrate, and we worship based on the many, many things you've done. And Father, as incredible as it is to hear of the wars that you've won and the giants you've defeated, the idea that you then would turn around, the killer of giants, the slayer of nations, and choose to show me grace, love, mercy, kindness, that's even more miraculous. Because I deserve the stone to the forehead. I deserve to fall on my own sword. And instead, you did that for me. You took the punishment I deserved. And instead, give me your riches, your family, the gifts I don't deserve. God, you are a great God, and we are just honored to be in your service. And we sing to you now out of the joy that it is to be a part of your family in your son's name.